Welcome to the We Society podcast, where we bring you solutions from the world of social science to some of society's gravest problems. I'm Will Hutton, a writer, a columnist for the Observer newspaper, and now I'm the president of the Academy of Social Sciences, the organization that brings you this podcast. Through this role and my past roles, I've seen firsthand how social science shapes the world we live. In this series, you'll hear from some fascinating academics and public figures who find the social sciences as vital and important, just as I do. British universities are one of our proudest national assets. We have 15 in the world top 100, but all's not well. There's the impact of Brexit, student numbers from Europe falling, lecturers on strike, and the prolonged COVID pandemic, all factors that have left a big imprint on our universities and their students. Vivian Stern is at the helm of navigating this turbulent sea as chief executive of Universities UK, a position she took up a year ago. Her organisation represents 140 universities across the country, from Dundee to Plymouth, Bangor to East Anglia. As of the 2022 academic year, UK universities and higher education institutions generated nearly £47 billion in yearly revenue. These are not just hallowed halls, but serious moneymakers. But in recent months, there have been setbacks. The summer of strikes by members of the University and College Union, UCU, meant some students graduated without their final grades. There is the Prime Minister saying he'll crack down on Mickey Mouse degrees. There are to be new government restrictions on international students, bringing dependents with them unless they're on research programmes. And above all, the value of tuition fees, frozen at £9,250 a year, but should be over £12,000 to have kept pace with inflation. Departments are closing at an accelerating pace. So do we value university education enough in Britain, or is it valued too much? Here with the answers is Vivian Stern. Welcome to the We Society, and thanks so much for making time for us.
My pleasure.
When we asked you to come on the We Society podcast, what was your first thought?
Well, I mean, knowing something of some of your previous guests, I was just very flattered to be asked. But I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm quite a fan of, you know, doing something to draw attention to the importance of the social sciences, given perhaps it's a kind of current political environment where people don't necessarily recognise the importance of the social sciences in, you know, national life.
Well, we think they're pretty damn important. We think, you know, whether it's economics, whether it's law, whether it's geography, whether it's statistics, whether it's finance, the sociology, political science, we can go on. I mean, this covers the gamut. And actually, you can't make policy in the public and private sector without the insights of some very evidence-based social science. And actually, they're pretty interesting degrees in their own right, because they combine element of a kind of quantitative kind of evidence gathering along with qualitative assessments and insights into kind of what makes the world happen. And that brings me to my kind of first question to you. Thank you for saying what you said about social science. But think even bigger. I mean, what in your mind as the chief executive of Universities UK is a university about conceptually? What's it there to do?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I was listening to the interview you did with Hillary Clinton, and you asked her the question, you know, what does the We Society mean to you? And it made me think of something that I've always thought. Well, I've had the privilege in my professional life of representing this enormously powerful set of institutions who do, I mean, in my view, colossal good in the world. And I, you know, the longer I've worked in the university sector, the more kind of deeply I have come to feel that they are, you know, for all the bits that are rough around the edges, for all the things that I guess on any day of the week might be, you know, good or bad in University X or Y, they're kind of like a perfect expression of something that is rather wonderful about human beings, which is that we kind of want to work together. We want to find stuff out and then tell the next person. And if you think about the essence of what is happening in universities, you know, generating ideas, not in a vacuum, but because you're listening to what other people have thought and said. and then trying to pass those on. And that sort of fact that universities, they exist around the core idea is create new knowledge and share it. And I think it's a perfect expression of something that's rather wonderful about human beings, which, you know, human beings aren't altogether wonderful, but that is rather wonderful.
I'm glad that you accent in that answer, not just finding out about kind of the world, but passing the information on. Mm. It's about research and teaching.
Yeah.
And of course, about the freedom to discuss, the freedom to disseminate, the freedom to go where your inquiry takes you. I mean, it's an absolutely kind of indispensable element of university. And I think also a degree of autonomy. I mean, you don't want universities to be strangulated by kind of anything. Yep. I mean, they must go where ideas and teaching takes them.
Yeah, there's also something, they're pretty unique in that they're spaces where people are allowed to, you know, take up blind alleys and fail and, you know, get things wrong. I think, you know, the essence of, I suppose, the international research effort is have an idea, test it a little bit, see if you're right or wrong, but being wrong is okay. And that's that sort of ability to be places where people can take risks, I think, is also rather wonderful and special and pretty unique, actually.
What is your view? We must do this early and get it out of the way. What is your view about, you know, the whole debate about, you know, safe spaces, no platforming, et cetera, et cetera?
I think, you know, you said it, universities have got to be places where people can, within the law, they can, you know, they can debate ideas and they can listen to views with which they do not agree. They should be places where we educate students to encounter things which are radical or uncomfortable or possibly even unpalatable and meet those ideas with critical challenge, not with, I don't want to listen to you because I find what you say upsetting. Now, the lived experience of a university trying to manage, navigate all of that, given that, you know, this is, that makes it sound very simple. And there are people who will give you to understand that it's a simple case of anybody should be allowed to say anything on a campus. Of course, it isn't as simple as that because you butt up against all sorts of things like, you know, an interlocking set of legal obligations. There are the requirements around sort of, you know, being able to maintain public order, all of that kind of stuff. So it's not as simple as some people would like to pretend. But fundamentally, I think there's a consensus amongst the university leadership in this country that the job of higher education institutions should be to help those people who pass through this system to disagree well.
That's certainly been my experience, because I spent a period of my career running at Oxford College, and that's certainly my experience. And actually, in the main, you know, the student body would say yes. I mean, I'm quite interested, where do you, before we've got so much to discuss, but just before we go on to something else, where do you think this intolerance of wanting to hear a view that might upset you or might make you feel you're not safe. And where does that come from? It wasn't around, say, 15 years ago. It's a contemporary phenomenon. Why is it? Is it an alertness to sensibilities that should be respected, or what's going on?
I don't know. I mean, I partly feel that, you know, universities are places where gears grind. Social progress, you know, sometimes plays itself out in messy and ugly ways in universities. That happens. That's historically been the case. And then what we're partly seeing is society adjusting its views on certain topics and those gears grinding in universities. I also think that it's very easy for people to dismiss those people who talk about their safety in relation to hearing somebody say something which will, you know, they will find very challenging and upsetting. But my dad's a Holocaust survivor, right? So I know, I've grown up knowing that words can have consequences. So I don't think it's as simple as to, you know, there are people who, when they hear predominantly, but not always, young people saying, you know, I don't feel safe because you have expressed a certain view, they might roll their eyes and say, well, that's completely nonsense. Nobody's threatening your safety. But I think if you think about it, of course, we know words can do real harm. They can catch fire in awful ways. And so I feel, you know, maybe more ambivalent around that question of, you know, is it a clear-cut case of these people just need to grow up and learn to listen to views they disagree with? I'm not sure that I feel that. I think that we ought to understand that there are ways that you can talk about certain topics which can do real harm to real people.
Your point is well taken. Words matter profoundly. John Locke wrote a great English philosopher, wrote his kind of famous essay on tolerance. And this is in the context of kind of, you know, at the time in the 1680s, it was all about the Anglican Church tolerating Catholics. But it was very interesting because he basically said, look, you can only come to truth through exchange of ideas. And that requires you to be tolerant of notions or beliefs that, and in this case, religious, that you can't, that you find kind of, that you object to. But you must allow your interlocutor to find his or her own way to the truth of what they believe. And the only way they can do that is by freedom to say their say. Yeah. I do think Locke's essay on toleration is a good starting point for this, you know. I mean, just tolerance all round. Mm. I mean, it's a great English tradition, actually, and very precious.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that is, I think, in most part what universities try to ensure happens, that people are allowed to express contrary opinions and deserve to be listened to with respect. Not every university gets it right in every case. I think there's a great...
Should we tolerate that too?
Well, I mean, at least not see a small number of incidents where a group of people might have handled something badly as evidence of a crisis in the sector. I don't think there is a crisis in the sector. I think universities, because they're right there at the sharp end of, you know, what I've described as the grinding gears of social progress, you know, of course it's sometimes a bit hot, but can we help them learn from each other? Can we help them manage it better? Can we help to navigate the sort of the competing responsibilities, including legal responsibilities, universities have in this space? I think we can, and we can probably do it without being too dramatic about the kind of state of British universities.
Now, there's a whole debate about whether market and commercial pressures are too intense on universities. And part of that, one way into that, is this kind of increasing pressure from the government about universities should surrender and stop offering what they describe as Mickey Mouse degrees. Where are you on that?
So it's not a new phenomenon, this charge that universities are teaching, you know, quote, Mickey Mouse degrees, unquote. I mean, I started working in the sector 20 years ago, and that was a feature of the political debate then. I believe it was a feature of the political debate when English literature was introduced as a subject in, I think, probably the 1870s, and people thought, what on earth are you doing adding this to the academic, the suite of degrees on offer? I also think, you know, I suppose this might sound rather naive, but I think if potential students have access to good advice and guidance about where the choices that they make going to university might lead them, you should more or less let them decide what they want to do. Because something funny happens when you let students study something they're interested in, which is whether or not there is already an avenue for them to apply the things that they have learnt productively. If there isn't, they'll probably create one. I'll give you one example. You mentioned Dundee in your introduction. You know, if you had been having this conversation maybe 10 years ago and you had been a different sort of person, you might have said, you know, what's all this nonsense about people studying computer games design? I mean, how can that possibly be a subject that you would study in a university? That sounds like a complete waste of time. They probably would have just dismissed it as people spending 3 years playing computer games. If you're Dundee, which is not a particularly affluent city, I don't think you need it doesn't need to be explained to you that the fact that principally Abbotey Dundee, so not an institution that's in the upper echelons of the rankings, has this extraordinary strength in digital arts and computer games, which has created a kind of group of people who probably didn't find it easy to get jobs, so they created their own. They set up their own little companies, and from that then they attracted in the big players, and now there's a computer games industry in Dundee which is really quite significant and a massive economic force. And I guess my lesson from that is let people study what they want, because, you know, they'll find a way to make that useful. It doesn't mean that every single graduate you know, will look back and think, I would make exactly the same choice again. I'm sure there is always a proportion of graduates who, if they had their time again, would do something different. But I think we shouldn't be overly you know, the desire to control the choices of students entering the system, I think, is a mistake.
Well, I recall at the beginning of the 2010s trying to persuade Oxford colleges that actually computer science was a valid degree subject. Yep. It was really tricky. And now, as on the verge of the fourth industrial revolution, artificial intelligence, I mean, you know, nobody would ask that question.
Yep.
I also think it's true that actually in all academic disciplines, there's gold at the end of the rainbow. You know, people, if they're passionate, will, in so-called Mickey Mouse degrees, which no one seems to have a name. I mean, when you say, well, what's this Mickey Mouse degree? No one wants to say, well, it's X. You might have said computer games, and then suddenly say, well, actually, there's this 100 billion pound industry.
Yeah.
But it does kind of get us into, you know, this question of, where's the money going to come from?
Yeah.
I mean, the government wants to close down Mickey Mouse degrees. It wants to stem the number of international students coming to the country, which are a very important source of revenue. It doesn't want to kind of fund universities directly with tax revenues. And it certainly doesn't want to increase student fees because, you know, there's so much kind of pushback on that. So universities are squeezed in the middle. Mm-hmm. I mean, is the sector in peril?
I mean, look, I think we're in a position which, if you let it drift, the consequence will be that we used to have one of the world's best higher education systems. That's what I think will happen. I mean, the way I describe it is I think we're kind of a little bit of a fork in the road. And if we take the path we're currently on, you just see the kind of slow diminution of something that we used to be really, really proud of. And I think we need, you know, our collective responsibility, not just ours in Universities UK, but nationally, I think our collective responsibility is don't let that path be the one that we take, because it's rather important to us as a country in an extremely competitive age that we have a higher education and research system that serves our national needs. And so we've got to make that happen. Now, how do you make that happen? Well, I think this is the hardest problem I've ever seen. And it's a bit like a puzzle box. You know, if I keep turning it round in my mind, and, you know, we discuss it all the time. You know, it's more or less I wake up thinking about it in the morning, I talk about it all day, and I go to sleep thinking about it in the evening. And, you know, you are told by those people holding ministerial positions right now, forget about it. Even if we had any money, which we don't, it wouldn't be coming to you. You know, there's schools and RAC and FE colleges all need money more than you. And then that's before you even get anywhere near the health service. So, it's a hard problem, right? We've got to work out, if you don't want a system which is sort of slowly run into the sand, we've got to collectively work out how do we get off that path and onto the other one.
You can see already what's happening. I mean, I know academics in kind of leading universities who, I mean, really think that actually you may have to retreat from teaching altogether and just take postgraduates and research and build the university around that, because teaching, you know, undergraduates is loss-making and actually no one's going to fund it. Or you charge an amount which is so high that actually only a minority of people can ever come to your university. I mean, it's a real... I mean, you can imagine, unless government grips this, our universities could transform in front of our eyes.
Well, I mean, I think I don't wish to be judgmental, but if you decided
that
your
strategy,
if your strategy was just concentrate on research, that would be a very bad idea, because unfortunately, teaching is loss making. Research is even more loss making at the moment. Universities recover about 70p in the pound for the research that they conduct. So and actually, the reason that we've had a reasonably buoyant research system, because universities are kind of quite unusual in that they can bring in cross-subsidy. I mean, particularly cross-subsidy from international student fee income. So this system needs a bit of balance. So you've got to you lose money on research, you lose
also,
money on domestic
also,
teaching.
Also, social science subjects, which are quite cheap to teach and quite profitable, and they're cross-subsidised. I mean, there's the cross-subsidies everywhere, actually.
I don't think even that social sciences are not profitable anymore. Then, you know, perhaps when the fee regime that we currently have in England, and I should mention that because it's a different system across each of the four nations, it may have been possible to cross-subsidise from humanities and classroom-based subjects into more expensive kit-intensive, lab-based subjects. But, you know, now I think we're getting to the point where nothing really is, you know, it's just a question of, is it losing a bit or is it losing a lot?
Yeah.
And But as I say, the cross-subsidy becomes very important, and that's where, you know, the international student population is pretty critical.
I just want to take a moment to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the WE Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. What are we going to do about making a career in academic life attractive? You know, I mean, there's a lot of kind of criticism of the lecturers and the academic community for coming out on strike. And I know these men and women. I mean, they're dedicated.
I think it's really important as well not to think that...
They're desperate, you know. They don't want to kind of have their students leaving without their knowing what their grades are. I mean, they feel pushed backs against the wall.
I think it's important also to just reflect on the fact that not every member of staff in a university or a member of academic staff is in the union.
Yep.
And not everybody who was in the union took part in the marking and assessment boycott. In fact, you know, it's been if you were a student who was affected by the MAB, by the marking and assessment boycott, and your grades were withheld and you couldn't graduate with all of your marks or your graduation was delayed, it's no comfort me saying you were part of a very small proportion of students who were in that situation. But it was about 2%, which means most of the academics marked their students' work and the students graduated on time. And I think that's important because, as you say, they've got relationships with their students. I don't think holding students hostage as part of the industrial dispute was a terribly popular tactic. But, you know, leaving that aside, universities are collections of people. They're good because they've got good people teaching and conducting research. And it is very important that we get out of the position we've been in the last few years where the industrial relations have been just pretty difficult. We've got a bit of responsibility for that through the USS pension scheme, which Universities UK has a formal role in representing the employer perspective. But it's been really tough. I think it's going to get easier on the pension front. On pay, you know, these forces that drive institutional finances also affect the freedom that universities have got to kind of sort out the industrial relations territory.
I mean, we have the frozen tuition fees at 9,250. Yep. I mean, there are people who said there should never have been tuition fees in the first place. There should be a graduate tax. Here we are. And if we keep it frozen and we try to stop international students growing, and if we don't want to put the taxpayers' money in, I mean, we're in trouble, aren't we? I mean, this is a sector which is, I mean, you say it keeps you awake at night. I'm not surprised. How do you see a way through it?
I describe it as kind of a little puzzle box. I think you just have to keep turning this one round and round. First of all, I think, we need to try and get to some sort of cross-party consensus on what the solution is for the medium to long term, because I don't think us continually tinkering with the higher education funding system is a good idea. I personally believe that the system that we've got, the design of a funding system which depends at least to some degree on the individual beneficiary of higher education contributing on an income contingent basis through loans. So they don't pay up front, but they pay when they're earning, and they pay to an extent which is connected with their earnings. That seems to me the right basis for a funding system.
I was chatting to two football Premier League chairs, completely kind of happenstance. And they volunteered the view that a town with a university in the 21st century that was analogous to a town having a cathedral in medieval Britain, that universities were the modern cathedral. They actually bring in students, they bring in life, they bring in youth, they bring in clusters of economic activity around them. Now, I'm not sure that universities themselves want to think of themselves in that way. I mean, when you think about levelling up, I mean, one of the ways of levelling up, I mean, it's already happened to a degree. If we hadn't got such a strong university system in some of our Midlands and Northern cities, they would be in a really powerless state. Mm. Should universities add to the notion of being kind of knowledge gatherers and disseminators of knowledge, that they're also wealth generators in the 21st century, given that knowledge is going to be so important to the 21st century economy?
They absolutely are. I mean, you know, to pick up on your point about, you know, these being these sort of amazing economic anchors, like you know, the cathedrals of the Blackpool is a great example. So there was a period of expansion of the university sector in the 60s where towns were invited to sort of put in bids to found a new university. And my understanding, and I apologise to the people of Blackpool if I'm getting this wrong, but my understanding is Blackpool sort of ummed and ahed about it, and maybe they did and maybe they didn't. And then by the time they got round, the kind of, you know, great and the good of Blackpool got round to putting in a bid for a university, the kind of door had closed. And I would say, you know, you look at the cities that did establish universities and what happened to them as a result. We commissioned a piece of work to look at the economic impact of universities, and across the whole of the UK, just through the kind of direct and knock-on effects of university activity, the value is about 130 billion. The sector is colossal.
That's 5% of GDP.
Yeah, it's
very big.
Yeah, and when you look at things like, we were talking about international students earlier, when you look at the fact that, you know, places that may not be otherwise particularly pulling in money from, you know, the wider world.
Yeah.
I was in Paisley, to give you a perfect example of this, I was in Paisley visiting the University of the West of Scotland 2 weeks ago.
Paisley Grammar School of the day.
And I checked into the hotel near the university, and I got chatting to the guy behind the front desk, who turned out to be the owner. And I wish I'd just videoed it and stuck it on social media, because he basically said, oh, the university's fantastic for my business. You know, the students bring their parents over for graduation or when they're, you know, coming to visit, and the university brings people into Paisley.
Well, we're getting near the end. I think it's been a great interview, and I just want to hear you. I sometimes say this at some of our interviews, and I'm going to make you a queen, monarchial, discretionary kind of power for a week.
Okay.
And you're going to transform university into higher education. What are you going to do?
I think it would take more than a week, but I'd reintroduce maintenance grants for students, because I think we got a problem with maintenance. I would invest more public funding, and I'd index the fee from 2026 onwards, hoping that inflation has come down a little bit. So a combination of those three things, I think, might get us into a slightly better and more sustainable place.
Good. And lastly, we're back in the Horizon programme from the 1st of January of next year. Your reaction?
I am beyond delighted. Elated.
Beyond delighted. I actually cried
when we found the news. I mean, it was just, this is something we've been working on for 7 years. It's good for everybody.
7 years?
Yeah, I mean...
It's
been a very, very long road. It's good for everybody. I think that it might sound like the kind of thing that only matters to researchers, but if you've got a rare disease, you want our researchers to be working with all of those people in other countries who also have little populations of people with that rare disease, putting their heads together and trying to work out what to do about it. So it's good for all of us.
It was extraordinary, wasn't it, that we got to where we got to?
It's been a long and very stressful road, but I'm delighted, and I think the government should actually be, you know, warmly congratulated for having secured a deal, which is actually, I think, a pretty good deal in the end.
And it's disappointing that we aren't opening the doors to EU students in the same way.
Well, you know, it feels to me like we might have turned a bit of a corner. There will be people who would like to see a bit of consideration of whether the Erasmus scheme might be worth thinking about again. And I think...
That would be extraordinary if we get that back.
I do regret the fact that we're not in the Erasmus programme, but that's a conversation for another day.
Okay, a conversation another day. Vivian Stern, thank you so much. It's been we've really covered some ground here. Thank you for your validation of social science on the social science podcast, the We Society. Thank you too for your kind of beginning at the end here to kind of point the way through the financial straitjacketing which the British university system is. Thank you too for your, I think, tolerant and level-headed remarks about safe spaces, for pointing out that actually only 2% of our graduates actually left university this year without knowing their grades. And above all, thank you for your resounding belief, passion and advocacy for the concept of a university as a place of learning, research and disseminating what you find as freely as you can and where the inquisitiveness and quest for knowledge takes you. It is, I think, a kind of fantastic assets for our civilization, these wonderful, wonderful institutions, and we're lucky to have so many of them that are so good in our country. Thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Find out more about the Society by going to www.acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast so you're the first to know when a new episode comes out.